I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. A recent high-profile drug bust closed the books on one of the biggest smuggling rings in Kansas City history. Over the course of several years, DEA agents tracked down the man behind an operation that was moving massive amounts of cocaine, meth, and marijuana through Kansas City. Today we'll talk with those who helped to shut down the drug ring as part of Operation Blockbuster and find out what it took to build a case against criminals operating in Johnson County. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. No one ever suspected that Alejandro Corredor was a drug kingpin. He was a family man who lived on Fontana Street in Fairway, of all places. He was Alex to his neighbors, and he didn't cause problems. But in that house, during the course of just a few years, the 37-year-old Columbia national made more than $5 million selling cocaine and marijuana. He was the boss of one of Kansas City's biggest drug trafficking operations, and he was involved in murder. Today we'll talk about the drug kingpin in our midst and Kansas City's status as a hub for drug trafficking. With us is Gilbert Trill. He's an assistant special agent in charge of home security investigations. That's the criminal arm of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Gilbert, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Assistant U.S. Attorney Joe Marquez is also here. He was the lead prosecutor in this case. Joe, good to have you too.
Thank you.
And also with us is Ian Cummings. He's a reporter at the Kansas City Star who chronicled all this in 913 magazine. Ian, nice to have you too.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, Fairway, Ian, Fontana Street is just a few blocks from my house. Describe this neighborhood to us. What's it look like?
It's a nice neighborhood. It's almost stereotypically suburban.
Yeah.
Tall trees, nice landscaping, people jogging. It's actually not far from where I grew up, so it was very familiar to me. And certainly you wouldn't expect to find a drug dealer on that street.
You know, what did the neighbors say to you about this idea that a drug kingpin was living in their midst?
Some of the neighbors we spoke with had known him while he was living there, and they were shocked.
I bet.
They described him as a nice guy, polite, clean cut. One of the neighbors that we talked about in the story just couldn't believe it.
And at first, he was really low profile, right? He didn't stand out.
That's what people told us, that when they initially moved in, he was a little bit unusual in that, you know, he worked in the music business, came and went at all hours, but he seemed like a family guy, a citizen. And then it sounds like later on, as his career changed, people began to get the idea that there was more to the story.
He was like Tony Soprano in some ways in this neighborhood.
Maybe like Tony Soprano. The chief of police knew him by sight and had always thought him a little bit of an odd duck, but thought he was just a young businessman.
You know, Gil, how unusual is it that a drug boss would choose, you know, a quiet street in a quiet suburb like Fairway as his home base here?
Not unusual at all.
Really? And why is that?
Just for obvious reasons. I mean, you want to blend into the neighborhood. You don't want to stick out.
And this happens all around the metro area, I gather?
All around the nation.
Yeah. So nothing unusual here.
No.
With all this, yeah. And just to be clear, did he deal drugs out of that house, or did he just live there and do his drug dealing elsewhere? What's your sense?
He was pretty savvy, so I don't believe he dealt directly out of that house. Or if he did, it wasn't very often. He had multiple locations throughout the city.
Mm-hmm. And it's certainly my sense from reading Ian's story that he lived in this $180,000 house. It was sort of like he was trying to disguise the fact that he had a lot of money, Joe. Am I seeing that correctly?
I think initially that's exactly what he was doing. You know, the way he lived his life at the very beginning was just that. It was to disguise what he was doing. So you weren't going to see a whole lot of flashy cars and things like that at the very beginning.
But that changed.
It did.
What happened?
Well, if you read the story, you know that he was involved in a rap production company. And I think that's where he started to somewhat advertise himself and his rap production company. So
that's what his love was. It wasn't dealing drugs, I gather. It was making music.
It was. I mean, that's eventually what he wanted to do. He wanted to get out of the drug game, and he wanted to produce rap music. So when that started to take off for him, obviously his profile got a lot bigger at that time.
You know, give us an idea of the size and scope of this operation, Joe, because how many people did the government put in prison as a result of this whole thing?
Well, we charged 31 people in three separate indictments altogether.
31 people?
Yes. And that's a rather large number to charge at one time.
Is it the largest in this area's history or not really?
I don't think it's the largest in this area's history. I think our office and the office in Kansas, we routinely file charges like that against multiple defendants. It's becoming the norm. I think your original question was how big was this group? This was a pretty good-sized group, and they had connections all the way down to Mexico. They had connections in Texas. They had connections in Colorado and California. So it was rather extensive.
But I imagine we see this kind of thing, as Gil said, all over the country.
We do. I mean, that's exactly what these cartels are doing and how their influence is in, Kansas City, their influence is in, Wichita, their influence is in Milwaukee. It's everywhere throughout the country.
Wow. Gilbert, give us a sense of how this particular operation worked. I mean, I think for you guys, this is sort of standard fare, but I think for listeners, how these guys work and how these operations work is something they don't know too much about.
Well, these individuals basically, like you said, he was under the radar. He bought legitimate businesses to hide his activities. He bought an auto garage to help, use that in order to hide the materials that he was doing, the drugs coming in and unloading those, and also to stash the money in. When you're concealing drugs or money, you have to make the vehicle look as
normal as possible.
Exactly. So basically that was it. I mean, he also had those connections. I believe the rap agency, although what might have been his passion, but he also used that as connections into the drug community as distributors and things like that. One of the individuals who was part of Block Life was one of his major distributors. Yeah. And that's why we call it Blockbuster, because of the Block Life Entertainment.
Mm-hmm. So. Gilbert, he stashed his drugs in these cars where? Where do you hide drugs in a car?
You can hide them almost anywhere. You'd be surprised on some of the traps that we locate. I mean, some of them are sophisticated as having to hit special buttons on your dash panel to open up electronic concealed compartments that you wouldn't normally hit if you didn't hit.
No kidding.
And some of them are just really simple, where they just cut a hole in the car and bondo it back up and paint it. So those are pretty much easier for the law enforcement to detect.
And how does law enforcement find that stuff? You have to simply dismantle the car these days? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, usually they use drug dogs. But we have some really good people out there, state, locals, federal, that just have this sixth sense almost. And they can, just from the indicators from the person they pull over to, the vehicles, knowing where there's actual voids in the standard car and looking for those areas. And then, of course, when we get information on our side, we can pass it over to state and locals to actually cause stops to happen.
And as a result, you can stash how much in illegal narcotics in a car? How many pounds of stuff can you get in there?
It depends on the vehicle. I mean, there's tractor trailers where they'll take a whole front end of the trailer, and they can stick hundreds of kilos in there. So, I mean, it depends on the vehicle and how much void space there is.
Yeah. Joe, give us a little more sense of how the operation worked. How did he get the narcotics? Where did it come from? How did the whole thing sort of work from what you found out?
Well, I'll borrow a phrase from the main agent that was working at ICE, and it was a perfect storm. Alejandro Corredor spoke Spanish, so he was able to talk to the Hispanics that were able to bring the drugs into the area. And obviously he spoke English too. So with the distribution side, like Gilbert said, with the rap production company, he was able to meld both of those together, bringing the dope in and then distributing it through his rap production company and the people that were involved with that. So it was just kind of a perfect storm for Alejandro Corredor to distribute drugs.
The dope came from where?
It came from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the way the investigation progressed, I mean, it came to the point where he was having direct contact with parties in Mexico. He was making phone calls with parties in Mexico. So he had a direct pipeline from the cartel on the Mexican side bringing the dope into the United States.
Ian Cummings, you wrote about this again for 913 magazine at the Star. Now, you described him as someone who was really good at what he did. He was good at selling dope. Describe his personality a little bit. Give us a sense of who he was. who he is.
Well, by all accounts, he was an intelligent guy, a friendly guy, sociable. It seems like, based on his career, he had some amount of self-discipline to avoid detection for a period of time and not do something stupid to get caught. But people liked him. Most of the people that we've spoken with that interacted with him found him to be a nice guy. They liked him. And I think that's probably important in a business like that.
And you also point out that this was a business where the transactions had life or death consequences hanging virtually on every single one of them. What did you mean by that?
Well, his testimony and the testimony of other people in the case talked a lot about how to lose one of these loads of drugs was a big deal. You know, the people that he was in business with in Mexico don't forgive those kinds of mistakes. So the stakes were very high, and that must be another component of his personality, that he was able to live, you know, under that sword of Damocles and wake up every morning and know that he had to move those loads and get that money paid, or who knows what would happen.
How much in narcotics was he moving and selling every month, just roughly? Do you have a rough idea?
At the height of his career, he was receiving up to 40 or 50 kilos twice a month.
Of cocaine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that didn't go on for a very long time, but I believe that was the height of his trafficking.
40 or 50 kilos, Joe, how much is that? Give me a sense of what that means.
Well, at the time that this was going on, a kilo was probably going for around $30,000 a kilo. So you can do the math. It's a lot of
$30,000 a kilo.
It's a lot of money involved in drug trafficking at that level.
And he's getting 40 or 50 of those things in here every month.
He was, and he was getting it fronted to him, so he would pay for it afterwards. So when he sold it, he would pay for the drugs after he sold it.
And he paid for it how?
Cash. This is a cash business.
And the cash would go where? Who would he pay?
There would be couriers that would come up from the cartel, and like Gilbert said, they would stash it in concealed compartments of cars, and they would send it back down to Mexico. In fact, we did, along with DEA, we did a couple of interdictions where we got about $2.5 million in cash off seizures.
So the cars come in, the drugs are offloaded, the cash gets paid, the cash is hidden and then taken back down.
That's pretty much correct.
Pretty simple stuff.
Very simple.
Yeah, okay. Well, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking this morning about Operation Blockbuster that just went down involving a man named Alejandro Corridor, who lived in Fairway and ran a very sizable drug operation here. Your questions are always welcome here. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Our email address is uptodate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Gilbert Trill, before we go more into this operation and how it worked, this idea that, you know, Kansas City is a hub for drug trafficking is going to surprise some people, but should it?
No, not really. I mean, we're centrally located. I mean, historically, I mean, just industry in general has used Kansas City over the centuries as a hub. So why wouldn't drug traffickers and human traffickers and things like that use it as a hub as well?
Okay, dumb question. It's a hub because why? Because the interstate's running through here, right?
Correct. It's centrally located. Everything, you know, you go north, you hit Iowa, you can go up to Chicago, you keep going, you go to the East Coast. It's a perfect location for a centralized hub.
So, Joe, some folks might wonder then how much illegal trafficking goes on in this town.
A lot more than people actually think. I came to the United States Attorney's Office from Jackson County. I was a prosecutor over in Jackson County.
Yeah.
I thought we did a lot of good work on the state side, and we did. And it wasn't until I became a federal prosecutor that I realized the scope of narcotics trafficking in this area. It's amazing. I mean, one guy, Alejandro Corridor, you know, we had probably somewhere in the neighborhood of over 400 kilos we could put on him in a two-year period of time, and that's just one guy in Kansas City. And there's, for every one Alejandro Corridor, there's probably another 5 to 10 that are doing the exact same thing that he is. So it's large in this area.
5 or 10 more Alejandro Corridors at any one time in this town.
That's correct.
Who's buying this stuff?
You've got it trickles down to the. It trickles down to the street level, basically. That's what it is. It's street level. I mean, when Alejandro Corridor was selling his kilos to his suppliers or his buyers, they would break down the cocaine into crack cocaine, and they would sell it on the street. So you're talking there is a large number of users in this area. And when you talk about the area, I mean, it's just more than just Kansas City. It's the metropolitan area. It's some of the areas like in central Missouri. I mean, the dope was going everywhere.
So Alejandro Corridor had a whole host of salespeople reporting to him?
He had a small, when I say a small group, he had probably 5 to 10 people that he would sell to. And those people would break down the dope and sell them to other people. So he was, you know, at the top of the food chain here, and he would sell large quantities to these 5 to 10 individuals, and then they would break it down and sell it into smaller quantities.
Yeah. Ian Cummings, you know, going back to the whole fairway thing, you know, the extent to which he was selling out of his house on Fontana Street in Fairway, close to where you grew up, close to where I live right now, how much of that was going on?
It doesn't sound like very much. Mm-hmm. I think that when his house was broken into, there might have been some drugs in the house at that point. But I haven't read or heard or seen anything to indicate that he was selling a lot of drugs in Fairway. And it seems unlikely because the people that he did business with, his friends, his circle, they weren't in Fairway. They were in Kansas City.
You tell an interesting story in your article about that break-in that you just mentioned. Why was he broken into, and what did the neighbor down the street observe that day?
His neighbor was talking on the phone on her front porch, and she knew Alejandro. And she saw two guys kick in the door and take this TV out. Why these guys chose that day to go and steal his TV, I don't know. But when the police responded, they found some things in the house that became a problem for Corridor, and he moved away shortly after. He never returned.
So he left. Mm-hmm. So how long had he lived in that house altogether then?
A little more than 2 years.
And how many houses did he have all over town? He had a bunch, as we've mentioned here.
He had a handful of rental properties in Kansas City. I visited personally three of them that he had owned one time or another on the Paseo, over off of Warnell. He had at least three that I knew of.
And what did he use those houses for?
He told people that he was renting them out, but I think that he was letting some of his associates stay there and hold drugs, maybe do some transactions.
Yeah. But what's your sense of how much money he was putting in his pocket every month as a result of what he was doing?
Well, he typically pocketed between $2,000 and $3,000 on the sale of a kilo. So depending on whether he was doing a load of 25 or 40 or 50 a couple of times a month, he made, as we said, over $5 million in the time he was living in Fairway. So
that's a lot of money, Gilbert.
Especially tax-free.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to some phone calls here. Again, our phone number, 816-235-2888. Again, our topic, Alejandro Corridor, the drug trafficker who lived among us. Let's go to Ben from Leawood. Ben, good morning.
Good morning. My question is, since we obviously have not failed in our drug programs to eliminate this and we failed with alcohol, why not just make all of them legal like we did with alcohol? Alcohol kills a lot more people than these illegal drugs do. But yet we tolerate it because the way we had it before with prohibition was worse. And we're not accomplishing anything but what we're doing now as far as the uses of illicit drugs.
Well, I knew we might open this can of worms at some point during this hour. Gilbert, what's your response to Ben?
Well, Homeland Security Investigations will enforce all the laws that are on the books. So he's welcome to try to get that changed. But until that happens, you know, we'll need to prosecute those as strictly as we can, but I can't really make an opinion on whether we should or not.
Joe, what do you think?
I'm going to have to defer to what Gilbert said. Obviously,
didn't think you'd go anywhere else. Yeah.
Well, obviously, this is the job that I've done almost my entire adult career. So, you know, the laws are on the books for a reason, and we're here to enforce those laws. You know, if you want to get in the politics of it, you know, we're not the people to probably talk to about that.
Yeah. What do you make of the politics of it, Ian? I mean, this country doesn't seem to be really ready to grapple with this issue anytime soon. Do you sense anything otherwise?
No, I don't. I think a lot of people raise that question. A lot of the people I've spoken with, including police chiefs and experts, few people want to be the person to say we should legalize drugs. But I think a lot of the people who are well-informed say that there's no end to this in sight.
Mm-hmm. Nowhere in sight, probably, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay. Who gave this operation the title Operation Blockbuster, Gilbert?
Homeland Security Investigations in my office did, yeah.
Well, who comes up with something like that?
Usually the lead agent does. I mean, they run it by their supervisor, but as long as it's appropriate, we usually let them go with it.
What's it based on? Like, where do you get something like that?
Well, the Block Life Entertainment was one of the nexus areas of this investigation. So Blockbuster was to bust Block, you know, basically break it up. And
yeah.
So, and it kind of had a catchy name to it.
You know, Ian, I didn't get the impression that Alejandro struggled to sell narcotics. He was gifted along those lines.
It seems that way. I remember him telling an anecdote during the trial, which I read in the transcripts, of him borrowing a kilo from a supplier that he had, and he sold it in one day, which I think is faster than usual.
Mm-hmm. He just knew how to do that stuff, it sounds like.
He had a talent for it. Yeah.
Yeah, and how do you – I mean, how many people have talents for something like that?
How do you even discover that you have a talent for that? I don't know.
Yeah, and where's he from? Tell us a little more about him.
Alejandro Corredor was from Bogota, Colombia. He moved to the United States in 1995 at the age of 18. He was staying with some family here when he came over. He worked some entry-level jobs, Burger King. He worked as a customer service representative. He talks a little bit during the sentencing about his life in Colombia, but I don't have any other sources about that. He talked about one of his family members being killed and fearing for his life at the time that he moved to the United States.
Hmm. So tough stuff.
It certainly sounds that way. And certainly there are a lot of people in Bogota who are living in very tough circumstances and are lucky to find an opportunity to come to the United States and find a different life.
Why did he want to turn to drugs? Any feel for that?
There's no real fine-grained explanation for that I've heard. You know, it sounds like he was working these jobs, as I said, and he fell in with groups of people that were using drugs and became familiar with that. And then he must, during that time, have discovered that he was able to sell them and make money quickly.
Yeah. Okay. So it was called Operation Blockbuster. Gil, when did you get your first inkling that this particular operation was operating around here? How did it come to your attention?
Well, Alexander Corder was involved in this drug trade for a while, and he came to our attention probably as early as 2004, but he just wasn't a kingpin at that time or one of the heads. It didn't actually come into this huge, you know, Blockbuster investigation until, I believe, early 2008, and that's when we started actually putting the resources together to investigate this, you know, drug trafficking organization, which we call a DTO.
Yeah. Do you recall how it first came to your attention, exactly how the tip came across the transom there?
No, I don't. I don't think there was really a tip that led us off. I mean, there was a lot of activity going on that kind of raises these things. Remember, as Joe said, there's a lot of these people out throughout the area, throughout the country. It's just when the culminated observable activity rises to a certain level that we actually open cases on them. So basically, the activity came there. We had, you know, allegations or, you know, basically information coming in from the public as well as previous arrests. This individual had been arrested multiple times on other things.
Alejandro had been?
Yes. multiple times was he arrested in association with or stopped during where drugs were seized or money was seized. So again, these people are associated with seizures or of drugs or money or like Alejandro, I think in your article, Ian, he was never anywhere without a weapon and at least some drugs and money on him. So every time he got picked up, he had drugs, money, and a weapon on him. So again, throughout the country, getting those prosecuted and having him be put in prison is, you know, whatever, either way. But basically, he, throughout the system, was becoming more and more of a leadership figure. And when he became a certain level, that's when the case was opened.
And how do you guys begin to approach people like that, Gilbert, in terms of he gets on your radar screen? Do you keep following him? I mean, is he someone you sort of keep an eye on, or how does that work?
Well, I can't really talk about methods and means, but yeah, basically observable activity and things like that.
Yeah. So he gets on your radar screen and you're certainly aware of him and you're sort of keeping an eye here, it sounds like.
Correct.
Okay. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here about Operation Blockbuster and Alejandro Corredor. Again, your phone number is welcome. Phone calls welcome, 816-235-2888, and our email address UpToDate @kcur.org. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our talk yesterday about the KU Cancer Center and the turnaround program, you can find it all and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, a look at the latest in development in the Kansas City area, including the Plaza, Leawood, and the entire Kansas City Metro. This hour, we're talking about Operation Blockbuster, a deal, an operation operated by Alejandro Corridor, a family man who lived on Fontana Street in Fairway, who ran a very large drug trafficking operation in the Kansas City area. I'm wondering if you have questions or if you wonder if you would recognize the drug dealer living next door. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. We're visiting with Ian Cummings, a reporter from The Star, Joe Marquez, an assistant U.S. prosecutor who was the lead prosecutor in this case, and Gilbert Trill, who's with ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Branch involved in this investigation. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. You know, let's go to some phone calls here. Paul from Leavenworth. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, what socioeconomic group is responsible for the most drug sales? Is it the more highly paid people, or is it the poor people?
Paul, you're wondering about who's buying the stuff, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Joe, who's buying the stuff?
You know, I think everyone is. I mean, I don't think it goes along social lines, you know, like this caller thinks. I mean, there are people in lower socioeconomic stratas that buy it. There are people in middle class that buy it. I mean, that's why it's such a problem. It's pervasive everywhere. It's not just a poor man's drug, whether it be crack, whether it be cocaine, whether it be methamphetamine, whether it be marijuana. I mean, it goes through all stratas. I mean, there's not one specific group that's causing a problem.
You know, is it your sense, you know, Joe, after all these years of this war on drugs, is it changing out there, or is it the same old story year after year after year? Is the demand decreasing? Is the supply decreasing, or is it just what it's always been?
You know, I don't see supply and demand changing much. You know, there are differences in how it's come through. When I was a Jackson County prosecutor, obviously, and I worked out of Independence, Missouri. You know, Independence, Missouri was considered the meth capital of the world because. Besides Independence and Riverside, California, you know, labs were being dismantled almost on a daily basis by the Jackson County Drug Task Force and the Independence, Missouri Police Department and the DEA and everyone else that was involved in drugs. The problem became once, you know, we got involved in trying to somehow keep pseudoephedrine from being used in the process, it went straight down to the Mexicans and the Mexican cartels being able to, you know, make methamphetamine down there and bring it up here a lot cheaper than if you were, you know, trying to run your own meth lab in out of your backyard or out of your basement or whatever. So
I can't buy Sudafed anymore, which is a product I use occasionally. I can't buy it, and that didn't make any difference, you're saying.
No, you can buy it. It's just regulated.
I mean, I can buy it, but I can't buy it like I used to be able to buy it.
Right. I mean, yeah. You have to go to the pharmacist to buy it. I mean, you mm-hmm. can, you know, you see how a lot of the cold medicine is now behind the pharmacist. But, you know, that changed the way, you know, methamphetamine was basically made. And it's a whole lot easier for the Mexican cartels to make it and bring it up here than it is for someone to do a lab in their basement or do a lab in
the
car.
Trunk.
Right.
Yeah. So that was the change that resulted in.
That was a big change in the methamphetamine area. But again, you know, I don't think there's been a whole lot of change in supply and demand. I think, you know, like I said, when people stopped making it themselves, they had to get it somewhere. And that's when the Mexican cartels came in and it was a lot cheaper for them to make and it's a lot cheaper for them to bring in.
So for every response from legislators or Congress or whatever, there seems to be another response coming back from the manufacturers.
Sure. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry. Of course they're going to make changes.
Yeah. Gilbert, what's your sense in terms of supply and demand in this country? Are you noticing any changes out there, or is it, the same old story?
I'd have to agree with Joe. It's the same old story.
You find that discouraging for someone who works, makes a career in this business, or does it keep you gainfully employed?
I guess it's job security, but... no, I don't find it. I mean, it's sad.
But why isn't it, though? Because we've been talking about this as a society for decades, and here we are having this conversation, and you're saying nothing's changed.
I'm not trying to answer that question.
Yeah. same old story.
I mean, we need to focus on the demand. I mean, that's the bottom line. We need to focus on the demand and get people help and get people off of drugs and being addicted to drugs. And that's the problem with, you know, the crack cocaine and the methamphetamine. It's so highly addictive. Heroin, all those drugs are very highly addictive. So you need to work on that end of it.
I thought we are working on that end of it.
We are. I just don't see at this point in time a whole lot of progress being made.
Yeah.
But that's how you're going to deal with it, because it is a business. I mean, the sale of narcotics is a business, and you have to look at it. I guess you have to look at it in that area and that from those lenses and say, you know, you have to deal with the demand. If you drive the demand, you know, then yeah. You know, there won't be that much of a supply.
Hey, how did Jackson County's war on meth and independence, how did that play out? What was the end result? Did you have an impact there, or did you just drive it elsewhere?
Well, we had an impact. And I think what I told you was, you know, it went from people manufacturing their own methamphetamine to just getting it from the Mexican cartels. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a vacuum that was taken up by the Mexican cartels.
So Independence is no longer known as the meth capital of the Midwest?
Well, as far as manufacturing, I don't know what the statistics are, because I've been out of Jackson County for a while. But I know those guys that still work the local level, I mean, they're still dealing with it, but they're not the lab numbers are down, and I think that's nationwide. I think that's because of our responses to the pseudoephedrine problem. But again, with supply and demand comes, you know, the Mexican cartels filling that void.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls again at 816-235-2888. Andrea from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi. I was wondering if you could talk about the stigma of, I guess, drug busts being like in Jackson County or Wyandotte County, like in Kansas City, Kansas, or Kansas City, Missouri, or Independence versus Johnson County. Growing up, I lived in a townhouse for a while in Johnson County, and the person on the other half of our townhouse, like the SWAT team came out one night and busted him because he was selling cocaine. And when I tell people that story, they, you know, find it hard to believe, because Johnson County just seems like a place that's not stigmatized by, you know, by the drug trade, I guess.
Yeah.
Do you have any comments about that?
Andrea, good question. What about Johnson County, Joe? Are you seeing issues there too? Because I'm told we're seeing issues there these days.
It's everywhere. I mean, it's not just in Kansas City. It's not just in Independence. I mean, it's everywhere. Wyandotte County. I don't do any work over on that side of the state line because my jurisdiction is in Missouri. But it's everywhere. I mean, it's everywhere. You can ask Gilbert. I mean, his guys run on both sides of the state line, and it's everywhere.
Gilbert, you agree?
Yes, it's everywhere.
No question about it.
Yes.
Okay. Let's go to Barry from Kansas City, Kansas. Barry, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a big fan of the show. I just had a quick question for your guest. Earlier you were talking about the character of Mr. Corridor and kind of to give us some insight as to how and why he was able to do what he did. And I was wondering if the guest thought that he himself used the user of drugs, considering he moved so much of them, and also just a quick question in reference to the story that was in the Star last week. If any time during the prosecution or the trial, if Mr. Corridor thought that he was eventually going to be caught and prosecuted. So I can take my question or the answer off there. Thank you very much.
Barry, thank you. Ian, did Alejandro Corridor use drugs himself?
He said that he did use marijuana, ecstasy, and also cocaine in the past, yes.
Because the pictures that ran with your story, just looking at his eyes, made me wonder if he wasn't using himself.
He was,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. How about this notion about whether he thought he might be caught or not? Did he live in constant fear of that, I gather, or?
I think he realized that was a possibility. Especially as he came under investigation, there were various times where he was arrested in connection with large loads of cocaine. So he was certainly aware of the danger. He knew that he was exposed. What I sense is that he didn't believe that he was really going to be arrested and sent to prison for most mm-hmm. of his life.
Joe, why was he arrested several times and then not held permanently? I'm sure your investigation was ongoing, but what was going on there?
Well, during certain periods of time, he was he had a student visa. He had a visa, a work visa. So it wasn't like he was an illegal alien that we could just round up and hold. But as part of the investigation, you know, when you have some of these arrests, you don't want, especially with the large scale investigation like this, you don't want to dismantle it too soon. We didn't know, you know, where he was getting his dope from. We didn't know who he was selling his dope to. So as the investigation was progressing, even though he would be stopped and arrested, to preserve the integrity of the investigation, we weren't able at that point in time, or we decided at that point in time, not to go ahead and blow up the investigation and start arresting people because we didn't know the extent of his little empire.
There was more to be learned as you went along, it sounded like.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we were aware, Homeland Security, DEA, we were aware that that this was bigger than just Alejandro Corridor. So, I mean, if you just arrest Alejandro Corridor with a kilo of cocaine, sure, he's going to get some time. But then we don't know anything about, you know, this organization. And so we don't want to spend all this time and money in these kind of large-scale investigations and end them prematurely.
Yeah. Gilbert Trill, give me a sense of how you do go about investigating someone like Alejandro. I mean, what kinds of tools are at your disposal to begin to crack down on something like this?
Well, again, we can't go into our exact methods, but, I mean, as the article kind of alluded to.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I mean, maybe Ian could actually speak to that better than me. But basically, as Joe kind of alluded to as well, we find the associates, and we're trying to go the upchain. Homeland Security Investigations is trying to find the international nexus, trying to find those international targets, and figure out how to stop the, you know, the head of the organization from the downstream. So, again, as Joe said, you don't want to pull him off too early because, yeah, he could do some time for a kilo of cocaine, but until you can dismantle the whole organization, and then hopefully that'll cause a void for a period of time before someone else takes the reins and starts heading up a new organization.
Yeah, but you can't – you're talking about going after the head of the organization. If he's getting his stuff from Mexico, you don't have any impact on undermining an operation that it's based in a different country yet, do you?
Yes, actually, Homeland Security Investigations has offices all around the world, and so we do work with our international partners. So does DEA, of course. So the federal government does, on occasion and usually is on the bigger organizations, works hand-in-hand with our international partners. There's these things called vetted units out in certain countries, which means that there's law enforcement from these international countries, other countries that are been vetted by the U.S. government to be trustworthy and things like that. They have access to some of our intelligence, and then we go and target these organizations.
I had no idea at all. So in this case, what was the impact of your investigation of what was happening in Mexico?
We actually weren't able to go up on the upline. The individual, Flaco, I believe his name was, actually, he ended up getting killed. So it kind of closed off that avenue.
Yeah. Give me a sense, Ian, of the kinds of tools that are available to investigators like this, wiretaps and the like. What kinds of things were going on to investigate Alejandro?
The wiretap is one of the most important tools. That provides all kinds of information and also provides connections, you know, from one individual to other groups, other individuals. And that's part of what led the trail back to Mexico.
But you point out that Alejandro would buy a cell phone, use it for a while, then toss it. So what good's a wire? I mean, can you get those kinds of phones wiretapped if he's disposing of them on a regular basis?
I don't think he was disposing of them that quickly. Certainly the phone that ICE was up on, he had for a few months at least. He did, and even when he tossed one, they were able to find out what the next number was and get a wiretap on that phone as well. So, yeah, he can dump his phone, but they'll get the next one. Mm-hmm. And he's got to use a phone to do his business. But they also did things like put GPS trackers on his vehicles.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Go through the garbage and find some of the trash that's associated with drug trafficking, surveillance, and presumably informants.
These GPS devices, I imagine, have to be pretty handy. And it wasn't a case like this, Gilbert?
Oh, yes. GPS devices are handy.
How did you use it? How did you take advantage of that?
I can't get into means and methods, like I said. But, you know, the most recent US Supreme Court decision on those has kind of dampened our use of those. So,
what did the Supreme Court say?
The Supreme Court basically said that you need to have a court order now to place on a GPS tracker. And actually, Joe would be better to speak that since he's an attorney.
Joe, you're laughing. Why?
No, I mean, it's true. I mean, GPS trackers are great ways of getting information. Obviously, the Supreme Court says we need to get search warrants to court orders to be able to do that. And we do that. It's just another step that law enforcement has to go through in order to get a GPS tracker, or, you know, steps we have to go through, legal steps we have to go through to get wiretap. So,
I mean, is that an arduous step, Joe?
Sometimes it can be. On the wiretap side, it's very time intensive. But again, as you can see from this case, you get a lot of information from those kinds of law enforcement tools.
And the GPS tracker, like, how does something like that get placed?
I can't really talk about how they get placed, but obviously they do, and we're able to use that information.
Yeah.
If a court believes, you know, we have probable cause to do it, then they will allow us to do it.
And the wiretaps, can you give me a sense of how many wiretaps you had on this particular suspect, Alejandro Corredor? How often that happened?
I think generally speaking in this case, we had 9 to 10 total wiretaps. Mm-hmm. On this case in a short amount of time. So it's good information, and it's a good way to keep track of people.
But you had multiple taps.
Yes, we had
this guy.
Multiple wiretaps.
And each time you put a tap on a phone, do you have to get a court order for that?
Yes.
I mean, if he's disposing of a phone, you have to go back and say, Judge, I need some more help on this case?
Yes, yes. All that is court authorized. We just don't get to, I mean, people don't understand this, we don't get to just wiretap people just willy-nilly. There are a lot of steps we have to go through in order to justify putting a wiretap on somebody.
Not to belabor this, are those steps fairly perfunctory in an ongoing case like this, or am I not seeing that
they
correctly?
Are not perfunctory. I mean, it is a lot of work. I mean, what people don't understand is, you know, we have to cross our T's and dot our I's in order to get these kinds of things. Again, it's not something, you know, people think that the federal government can go in and, you know, wiretap, you know, everything, telephones, cell phones, everything, just because we're the federal government. That's not how it works.
Is it too difficult?
It's not too difficult, but it is difficult.
Okay.
There's a reason for that. I mean, we just can't willy-nilly just do whatever we want to because we're the federal government, where there are rules and restrictions we have to abide by.
Back to some phone calls here as we talk about Operation Blockbuster and the drug dealer living among us on Fontana Street in Fairway, Alejandro Corredor. Deborah from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I read the story in the paper yesterday, and all I kept thinking was, thank goodness we have men and women such as yourself that worked very hard and are very motivated and risk their lives to keep these people out of our communities and off of our streets.
Yeah, I had the same reaction, Deborah. Good point.
And I just want to say thank you so much for not giving up on them, and thank you for the risks that you take on a daily basis to keep us safe.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for that. And then I do have a question.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Related to the murders of the two sisters in Edgerton, the person that allegedly committed the crimes was high on meth. Now, is there any way that the person that he got the meth from could be charged as an accessory or could be charged in some way because he was high on meth when he committed the crimes? Also, when other crimes are committed, when people are high like that, is there maybe some laws or something that's changing that would allow the law enforcement community to charge the drug suppliers as well?
Deborah, hang on the phone. Let me make sure I get your questions covered. Joe, fire away there.
I don't think there's a way to charge a supplier in that case up in Platte County with any kind of crime. I see where you're going with your question, but I don't think there's any way that person can be charged with a crime.
Because, I mean, he's the person that's making the drugs. I mean, they know that they're illegal.
Help her understand that, Joe. Yeah.
Like I said, I see where you're coming from. I don't see how you can charge somebody with selling drugs, because then presumably this guy that committed these homicides, because how are you going to get that information before a court that person sold the alleged killer, you know, methamphetamine? So you're going to have your alleged killer is going to be your main witness against the drug supplier?
Mm-hmm. Gilbert, give us a sense of how many hours a week at the height of this investigation you were putting into investigating Alejandro Corredor. How did that work?
Well, my office actually, I had the office, so I personally did not do this investigation. So I can't really speak to my hours, but mm-hmm. I had my entire office was at one time dedicated to this investigation. So all four of my groups basically were focused on this investigation.
And when folks focus, Gilbert, how many hours a week are they putting in?
My agents.
This is not a 40-hour work week, I gather.
Oh, no. Federal agents are required to put in 10-hour days to begin with. So,
is that, why is that?
That's just part of the statute.
4 days a week or five?
5 days a week. Now, it's an 8-hour day that's required, and then you have to average a 2-hour additional throughout the week. So you can work 12 hours one day, and then those a couple other days during the week, you could just leave it at 8.
And but, why is that? Help me understand that.
It's just part of there's a statute out there. I can't recall exactly what it is. It's going through my head. But basically, in order to save the government money, which in the past, basically any time they worked past 8, you had to pay them overtime.
Mm-hmm.
All special agents throughout the government, federal government, are paid an additional 25%. But then the federal government has the ability to work them 24/7 if they'd like to. So my agents in this case were up 14, 20 hours. I mean, it depended on what was going on. If they were watching the individuals, they were up. They could have been up 2 days straight. But
yeah.
So they did a stellar effort on this case.
And Joe, as a prosecutor, when do you guys begin to weigh in, and how much time do you wind up putting in a case like this?
Generally speaking, on a case of this magnitude, we come in fairly early in the investigation. The agencies say, hey, you know, this is a large-scale investigation. We open up a case in our office, and we do spend a large amount of time. I usually work more than 8 hours a day when I'm involved in an investigation like this. I spend as much time as I can with my agents doing whatever they need me to do on my end. It's a really good working relationship, especially when you get into a big case like that. So it's more than 40 hours a week, obviously. Everybody's getting their money's worth from both the courts, from the federal agents, and from the prosecutor's office.
Hey, to tell us about the deals you made in this case, Joe. How many folks pled out compared to how many you actually took to trial?
I had two separate trials. The first trial, there were 5 defendants that went to trial. The second trial, there were 3 defendants that went to trial. 31 people were indicted altogether. So most people pled guilty. Some with plea agreements, and you know, there's a misnomer when people think about plea agreements. We don't always give something up in our plea agreements, you know, to get someone to plead guilty. In Alejandro Corro's case, we had so much evidence on him that he had really no other alternative than to cooperate and assist with the federal government because we had so much information, so much evidence against him that if he were to go to trial, he easily would have been convicted. So that happens normally. We have so much information, so much strong evidence against people that they would rather plead guilty and get a few court-ordered breaks. If you plead guilty, you get a couple levels off for acceptance of responsibility. So it's a benefit to you to plead guilty. And if you go to trial, like the 5 went to trial and were convicted, and if you testify and you're convicted, you'll get some additional enhancements for obstruction of justice. So the way the system is designed is if you're going to plead guilty and you're going to save the government the expense of going to trial, you get a little bit of a break.
Yeah.
So most people pled guilty in this case.
And so Alejandro pled guilty to what? What did he finally get sentenced to?
He pled guilty. He went ahead and pled guilty to the conspiracy. He pled guilty the conspiracy to distribute cocaine, bulk cash smuggling, money laundering, alien in possession of a firearm. Those were the charges he actually pled guilty to.
And he'll be in prison for how long?
He got a 30-year sentence.
And where is he today?
I'm not exactly sure what federal facility he's at. I'm not sure at this point in time.
You know, Ian, one part of this story, we're running short of time now. You get into the whole M word, murder. What happened there? How does that connect to this case?
What happened there was that he was doing business with this man, Flaco, in Mexico, who was his one of his primary connections to the Sinaloa cartel. Flaco called Corridor and told him that there had been a load of drugs stolen in Kansas City, Kansas, a load of marijuana, and he needed to find it. Corridor did. Well, Corridor found it, according to him, in the possession of an acquaintance of his, and Flaco told Corridor, you've got to have this guy killed if he won't pay it back. And that's what Corridor did, was he paid 2 people to murder this guy.
But he wasn't sentenced on murder charges, was he?
No, he's not. That was part of his plea agreement. That information was the relevant conduct. We call it relevant conduct in a plea agreement. So the court knew that he was involved in that. He was also involved in another assault that took place that was cartel ordered. So the court took all that into consideration when she decided to sentence him.
You know, there's a moment, Ian, in your story when Alejandro Corridor is sentenced. and he asked the judge for one thing, which was to be able to hold his daughter. How did the judge respond to that, his newborn daughter? How did the judge respond to that, and how did he react to that?
Well, actually, his daughter is 2 years old now, mm-hmm. or thereabouts.
Okay.
But
he had never held her before.
He'd never seen her in person before.
Okay, yeah.
She was born after he was arrested. Corridor did not react in any way, shape, or form. The judge clearly was trying to send a message, especially about the murders.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the 30-year sentence, which was more than had been recommended by mm-hmm. anyone in the courtroom. And as she said, she viewed him as cold and calculated.
Wow. Well, thank you all for a good conversation here about the drug dealer in our midst. Thank you all very much. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
That's Gilbert Trill. He's with ICE, Assistant U.S. Attorney Joe Marquez and Ian Cummings from the Kansas City Star. His story appeared in the latest issue of 913. Yeah, okay. You can find out more about our guests and more information about our show at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Tomorrow, development reporter Kevin Collison fills us in on the latest business dealings in Kansas City. Today's show is produced by Danny Alexander. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.